So today we're going to hopefully finish up, guys, we're going to hopefully finish up Kashrus today. We're doing the sugya of tuna fish. What are some of the halakhic issues of tuna fish? Snapir mikaskeses. Are tuna fish even kosher? Sounds like a stupid question. Right?
I don't eat tuna.
They have fins and scales. Okay, so apparently, the Minchas Yitzchak, if you look on page 65, okay, Dayan Weiss claims that yes, tuna fish do have scales, but the scales are incredibly small and they're incredibly difficult. I don't know, I've never seen a live tuna fish before. But apparently, tuna fish, I mean, look at this picture, this is the closest to a live tuna fish I've ever seen, page 64. Apparently, tuna fish scales are very, very small, they're very easy to miss. And therefore, it could be that one man made the mistake. Tuna fish don't have scales. Now, the truth is, there are other types of fish that we're not going to talk about so much in this particular segment, but I'll just mention it as a point of reference. There was a big machlokes that raged in the last 20 years about the status of a fish that was known as the kingklip eel. It's not an eel, it's a fish. It's called the kingklip eel. That fish was native to the area around South Africa. That fish had scales. The problem was, when he pulled it out of the water, all the scales fell off. So the question is that fish kosher? Well, someone tell me a svara, one way or the other. Yeah.
Well, at the time of taking it out of the water, when you're prepared to eat it, there's no scales. It's not kosher at that time.
Oh, you almost had
but
it?
When you
almost
catch had it, at the time that you catch it, at the time that you take it, it is.
Tell me a diuk from a pasuk. Prove from a pasuk, one way or the other, that if a fish loses its scales, and you pull it out of the water, either it's good or it's not.
Which one fish is the snapir? The scales or the caskeses?
Snapir are the fins, and caskeses are the scales.
Because it says by my own.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. What does the plastic say? Bamay, next year. That's the key word. Bamayim, bayamim, banichalim, etc.
So
right?
It's kosher even if it's...
As long as a fish has scales when it's in the water, it really makes no difference whether it has scales out of the water. That's the deal that some wanted to make. A lot of posts get debated that, debated the status of the king of the eel. Sturbach has a very harif tshuva where he basically says that anyone who eats that fish is basically just eating treif, so don't eat it. But, again, that's not the main topic for right now. Flip that page. 66, we have the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says explicitly in Yerideya that even if the scales fall off when you pull it out of the water, the fish is perfectly kosher, it's tar, it's mutter, lechat chila. Says the Rama, adds on here at the end, the Yesh Omrim, the Ila Hatr Mekaskeses Achas, Rak Kishahi Omedes, Tachas Lichayav, Oznavo, Osnapiro, Tova Hachmer. The Rama is a Chumra. The Rama says that you should not permit one scale, meaning if a fish has only one scale, Asher, if a fish has only one scale, that should not be enough to permit that fish unless that one scale is either under its jaw, tail, or fin. Meaning, if a fish has one scale not in one of those three places, the Rama suggests as a Chumrah, it's a good idea to not eat those fish. What's the svara behind that Rama? Meaning, what's the difference between the scale under the fin, whatever, under the fin, jaw, and the tail? Okay, so without being cynical about the Rama's Chumrahs, let's try to figure out a real svara. Why do you think the Rama holds that when there's one scale underneath the tail, fin, or jaw, that's mutter lechatchila completely? But if not, it's only one scale in some other area, then it's tova achmir. Yes, Kiva.
Those are protected areas.
What do you mean?
Under the fin.
Okay, good. And therefore what?
And therefore, there's no reason that they should be knocked. If they're there, they're there naturally.
Yes, you're coming to the Kaf HaChaim. Beautiful. The Kaf HaChaim in the next mucker says literally what you just said. The Kaf HaChaim says that when you find a scale in one of those three places, you can be guaranteed that that scale came from that fish. There's no way a scale came from some other fish. That fish scale, without a doubt. You find a scale in some other part of the body, so who knows where that's. Maybe the scale fell off from a different fish and then latched onto the fish here. So one scale, the Rama says, not in one of those three places, is not a good raya necessarily. Again, he's not saying it make radin. He's saying it's a chumrah. But he's saying if you want to be machmir, right? So it's a good idea in that case. Beautiful. Now we have the Chasam Sofer on the bottom of page 66. Okay, Chasam Sofer has the following. Okay, he talks about what. First of all, just let's get a little bit of fish biology, marine biology now. Okay, what do fins do? What exactly do fins do? Yes?
They propel the fish forward and also allow for the airways to...
Good. Okay, good. Right, basically allows the fish to swim in the water, right? We move the fish. And the scales, what do the scales do?
Allow it to breathe.
To push out the moisture from the body. Exactly. Okay. Now, we mentioned briefly yesterday in the context of... We mentioned this by turkey and by the smoothie discussion a little bit, but we'll get back to this a little bit more right now. Remember we spoke about the Gemara Bechoros? Gemara Bechoros says that when you have an animal that's born from a Tohar animal, by definition it's Tohar and vice versa. So for example, if a cow gives birth to a fetus that looks like a horse, it's still kosher, right? Because the Yotzim and Atar Tar and Ayotzim and Atar Tar. That's the idea of the Gemara Bechoros. Let's say you have a fish that's born from a Bitzas Dag Tohar. Literally a eggs of a kosher fish, right? So then the idea is that even if that fish has no simani tahara, has literally no fins and scales, the same way that we said by animals, hayotim and atar atar, that fish is going to be tar. Where it's awesome so far. I have no simanim of tahara on the fish, but I know that it was born from an established kosher fish. Tassim Sofer says that is tar. But what if we have a fish that we don't know who the mother of the fish is, right? I don't know, the fish swam away from its school, right? We have Dory. No idea. Right, Dory, exactly.
Today,
Let's hold off on the DNA question. That's a question you can ask them literally every single subject ever. We'll hold off on that for now. So let's say I cannot figure out whether this fish comes from a kosher fish or not. So then, obviously, you're going to require simani tahara in order to make this fish kosher, right? You can't just eat the fish if I have no proof that it's kosher. Okay, so that's the main point of the Chasam Sofer over here. Okay, we'll go to Rav Ovadia, bottom of page 67. Rav Ovadia discusses everyone's favorite food, sardines, right? What's the kasha about sardines? What? That's not a kasha. It's a statement. That is not the question we are asking by sardines. Guys, Eitan, what is the question we have to ask by sardines? Not are they kosher, that's not the question we want to ask. Bishul Akva, right? So explain. How are sardines made? How do you make sardines? Well, pickle, smoke them, right? Block, salmon, smoke them. Okay? There's a big machlokas, whether smoking, not this kind, but like smoking salmon, smoking lox, smoking sardines, does that have the status of bishul? Okay? Remember, Asher, remember we spoke about earlier in the beginning of the summer about frying, right? Remember we talked about whether fry is status of bishul? Right, machlokas, rashi, tosos, and sanhedrin, right? So, but it comes to smoking, the Yushalmi seems to assume that smoking may also have the status of bishul. It's very unclear. Again, when it comes to the local Shabbos, no one's going to tell you that smoking is mutter. And that's true of both of us, by the way. But no one's going to tell you that smoking is mutter on Shabbos, because you're doing malacha, obviously. But Megame Bishul, in terms of, say, Bishul Akum, Basar Bechalav, etc., that's a big question, what the status of smoking is going to be. So if you look at Rav Ovadia, he makes the following hard. First of all, there are two major exceptions to the dinim of Bishul Akum. When does Bishul Akum, assuming that you have Bishul, obviously, regular Bishul, when does Bishul Akum for sure not apply? Which two cases do we for sure not have a problem with Bishul Akum? That's not even called Bishul Akum. I'm saying a guy mamish made the entire food. Literally everything. There was no Jew involved whatsoever. That's what Eitan just said. Yes. Good. Bishul Akum means that you have perfectly kosher food. It just happens to be cooked by a non-Jew. It's gzeira d'rabbanan. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that you're not allowed to eat food, even if it's kosher, it's cooked by a non-Jew, because we're afraid you're going to love this food so much, you're going to come to intermarry and marry his daughter. That's what the Gemara says. It's gzeira d'rabbanan. So today, Bazman Azeh, we're very machmed on Bishul Akum, right? But you have to define, what does Bishul Akum mean?
We have a lot of restaurants that...
Everything that people are saying right now is that, well, if a Jew turns on the fire, if you're Ashkenazi, or if a Jew does a little bit of the cooking process, if you're Sephardi, that will circumvent the Bishul problem. But I don't want to talk about that, because there, that's not Bishul Akum. That's Bishul Yisrael, right? In other words, whether your whole Bishul Yisrael is I turn on the fire, or whether it means I start stirring the whatever, the food, making the food, that's not called Bishul Akum anymore, right? That now loses the status of Bishul. I want to know, I have a non-Jew who makes all my food for me, from beginning to end. He turns the fire, everything. It's Mamich, it's Bishul Akum with a Hajj. No, in the restaurants, the mashkika turn the fires. No, it's not going to help you. I could have kosher lemahadrin food if it was made by a non-Jew. It's going to be treif. It's bishul akum. Okay, so we said the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says it's Zera Derabana because we're afraid. It's called Chaskos. We're afraid to come to the internet. Again, why that reason? Okay, so we're not going down the Chaskos street right now. We're not going to the Chaskos. Guys, the Gemara says in Avodah Zarah there are two exceptions to the rule of Bishlakam, forgetting about circumventing Bishlakam in the first place by having a Jew turn the fire on. One exception is called Nechal Kemos Shehu Chai. What does Nechal Kemos Shehu Chai mean? Nechal Kemos Shehu Chai. That means if something can be eaten raw, meaning it's edible raw, then just because a non-Jew cooked it doesn't mean it's called Bishlakam. For example, I have carrots. So you can eat carrots raw, you can eat carrots cooked, right? So if a non-Jew cooks carrots from beginning to end, perfectly mutter, I'm allowed to eat those carrots. Why? Because the din is when something is nechal kemos shehu chai, it's perfectly edible the way that it is. So then the non-Jew didn't do anything. It wasn't marbiya. I could have eaten that food regularly without him cooking it. Therefore, nechal kemos shehu chai is the first exception to the rule of Mishnah. Before we take one more second, guys, what would be, show me an example of something which is nechal kemos shehu chai. Okay, let's leave out like the vegetables.
Salmon.
All the
sushi.
Sushi, there you go. Sushi is a perfect, why? Sushi's raw. Sushi's raw fish. It's literally raw fish.
Not,
right?
not all of
them. Okay, most sushi is raw fish, right?
Sushi
is an example of something which is nechal kemos shehu chai, which means if a non-Jew made sushi for me, lechora it should be mutter to eat. Now, as we'll see, this will play into the sardine question in a second.
The rice is cooked.
Well, what?
The problem is the rice is cooked.
Okay, what's up? What?
So it's actually cooked.
Meaning, we're talking about if a non.
And you never find a Jew making sushi.
Okay, the non-Jew did all the work here, right? All the cooking process. Well, as Asher pointed out, he may cook the rice. The rice may be a different issue. I'm saying, look, God be the fish at least. Bishul Akam applies, at least at this point, what we said. Bishul Akam applies to anything which was not edible raw and is now currently edible because it was cooked. So, for example, rice, as Asher pointed out, rice is something which is not edible raw, and therefore, when I cook the rice, so sushi may be a problem anyway because of the rice. What's another exception to the rule of Bishul Akam?
What about sushi? You just have to chew the rice.
Okay, fine, whatever. You can get around that problem. Guys, what's another exception to the rule? What? That's too general. What? I could have. What?
It's in European countries that have raw meat.
Yes, that's actually, by the interesting you mentioned that, the Shlomo Zalman makes a fascinating hara. The Gemara in Shabbos says that raw meat on Shabbos, you're allowed to carry, it's not mukta, but raw fish is mukta. Why? The Gemara says, because no one in their right mind would ever eat raw fish, but people apparently ate raw meat. So today, the post can point out that it's just the opposite. Today, people eat raw fish, and no one eats raw meat, apparently. It's
beef jerky. Yeah.
Yes, correct. Correct. Okay, the other exception to the rule of Bishlakam, very important, it's called Eino Ola al Shulchan Melachim, something which is not fit to go on a king's table. Okay, that seems like a very vague criteria. What would be an example of something which is not fit? Yes?
Disgusting vegetable.
Okay, let's not talk about a food that rotted. Let's talk about a food, just the food by itself.
It has a good food. Sardines.
Let's not get to sardines yet, we'll get back to that. Well, we'll get back to sardines
something
in a second.
Something has intrinsically bad smell.
How many of you guys here eat at Dunkin' Donuts?
What?
How many of you here eat at Dunkin' Donuts? Okay. Why is it mutter for you to eat at Dunkin' Donuts?
Because it's kosher.
Because it's delicious.
Why is it mutter for you to eat at Dunkin' Donuts?
Because it's mashkia.
Because? Oh.
Hey, Joe,
donuts?
Obama eats donuts.
Obama's not a king.
Not to the corner. Okay. The din is like this. Something which is not fitting to be put... Guys, listen up. Something which is not fit to go on a king's table is not subject to the din of Bishul Akam. Okay? Now, I'll tell you where this plays out lahalakha. How many of you here are makbid during the Aseres Mechuba to only eat pasta shrub? Are any of you makbid for that?
I think so.
You think so. Okay, so then maybe... That's a chumrah quoted by the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam, brought down lahalakha. Meikra Adin... In order to understand this chumrah, you need a little bit of background. Okay, Meikra Adin... If a non-Jew bakes bread, you're really not supposed to eat that bread. Right? Pasakum really is not okay. But there's a heter in the Gemara that's called Pas Palter. What's Pas Palter?
To a bakery.
A bakery.
So much stuff.
Because bakers mass produce bread, the whole gzera of chasmus, of, oh, I'm going to marry their daughter, doesn't apply. Because who's like, who's Fryhofer's daughter? I don't know. It's Fryhofer. It's like, it's a company that makes
who's
bread.
Fryhofer?
A bread company.
No, I know, I know. I'm saying, like, you don't know any.
Right,
any.
I'm saying, as opposed to if I buy bread from a local baker, like some guy, a guy who has a little tiny bakery. From Max Baker, he's Jewish. But yeah, from a non-Jewish baker, a local baker. So then apparently there's a real chashad of chasmus, the gzera applies. Past Palto, the Gemara says, the Ikra din is really mutter, but as a chumra, doing that, says me true, we're trying to be more makbid on halacha, we makbid to only eat pas Yisrael. Now, so here's the question. Here's the question. Is Dunkin' Donuts mutter, if you're makbid for this chumra during Aseres Mechuva, are you allowed to eat donuts? So that's called Amaratis. We don't do that. So let's try to figure out what the halacha is. If I'm makbid for this chumra to not eat pas Palto during Aseres Mechuva, Well, Asher, explain to me. How are donuts made?
Deep fried.
Is deep frying called cooking?
Deep fried.
This is a throwback to the Machlokas we had earlier, Machlokas Rashi Tosfos, right? Whether tigun, and by the way, there may be a distinction between frying and deep frying also. But tigun, whether frying, is called a form of cooking. If you assume that frying is not cooking, then there's no issue at all. It's not visual anything. It's frying. So therefore, go to Dunkin' Donuts or Aseres Mechuva, mutter, lechachila, lahadrin, all your everything fine. But what would be problematic to eat during this issue? What about Entenmann's donuts? What about Entenmann's?
Deep fried.
How are Entenmann's donuts made?
Deep fried.
They're baked.
They're mass produced.
Entenmann's are mass produced. Right. No, correct. Correct. That's true. It's not bishlakim. It's paspalter. I mean, but during this issue, Mechuba, if your mouth bid, so then lechura, it would be a problem to eat entomates.
But it's not really food, it's just chemicals.
Okay, well that's true of virtually every food in the world. But, okay, so entomates theoretically should be a problem. Okay, but that goes a little bit off topic. Anyway, so we have our two exceptions to the rule. Number one, what was the first exception? We have nechal kamos shehu chai, right? That if something is edible raw, there's no bishlakim. Number two, if it's ain't ola shulchan malachim, no king would ever eat that food. Then, guys, then it would be, yeah.
What about a case where the food, like let's say a radish. Yep. Radish could be eaten raw, could be eaten cooked.
Correct.
But it's like covered in dirt and grime. You can't eat it unless...
You're saying that cooking will get rid of the dirt.
Not even cooking it. Like if she peels it and...
That's not a din in the food though. That's a din in the food. It happens to be dirty. That's different.
The peel itself is edible.
I'm saying peel it off and you'll be able to eat the radish.
Yeah.
Here we're talking about where the food intrinsically is not edible raw. The only way to eat the food is by cooking. Okay? So those are the two criteria to the exemption of the rules. Says Rav Avadya, he says, what would be the nafkamina between these two reasons? Let's say I told you there are two svaras behind this, when there's no bishlakim. Either it's in Ola Shulchan Malachim, right? Or that's Kosh Yukai. So what would be a case of, what would be a nafkamina? And something which is edible, raw. Nafkamina would be sardines, dug in katana, right? Small fish, herring, sardines.
Well, meaning, seals eat them raw.
Seals aren't king. That's how I checked, right?
Yeah, he says, they're sea lions, and lions are the kings of the jungle.
Guys are crazy. Anyway, so Ravaja says, and the Gemara says he should wear its filling. So what?
Sea lions.
Sea lions.
I don't
actually
know. Yeah.
Lions are king of the jungle.
The Gemara is
not
king
of the sea. It's about $2,700. Okay? Now, guys, Ravaja says like this. That since... since Bishul Akum is only an Isser Durabana, like we've already established, right? Guys. Since Bishul Akum is only an Isser Durabana, like we've already established, therefore, if a person has... If you have one of these two kulas, meaning it's either Nachal Kamos Shehu Chai, it's edible raw, or it's in Ola, Shulchan Malachim, says Ravaja, be Mekel. If you have one of the two kulas, because it's only Durabana, we can be Mekel. Now... The Shulchan Aruch says that you have to salt the fish first. When the Shulchan Aruch says that you have to salt the fish first, so what's the context of that Shulchan Aruch? So he's discussing larger fish, which apparently in certain situations can be Ola al Shulchan Aruch. Okay, but the bottom line is, if I have fish which are either Nechal Kamot Shehu Chai or are Eno Ola al Shulchan Aruch, so says Rav Avadya, Meikar Adin, it's going to be Mutter. Why? when it comes to the Isser Derabanan of Mishalakum, because Holy Derabanan, we're going to be making to say if I only have one of the two kulas, that's good enough to allow me to be able to eat the fish. Okay. The Bach quotes, the Bach, that small fish are always going to be, fish that will be small forever, meaning fish that are not just, they're small, they're going to grow up later, but fish that are just always going to be small fish, those are olal shokolah. Meaning what? Sardines. Sardines don't grow. Sardines are small fish forever. They're going to get canned and smoked, right? Sardines stay small forever. So a sardine, according to the Bach, is olal shokolah, which now means we have a problem, we were back to our bishalakim problem.
What about the
Oh, one second. We're saying, it's not a tegel question, it's a smoky question. So we have a suffix about that. The Yerushalmi is not sure. But says Rav Uvadja the following very important akuda. Rav Uvadja says, this suffix as to what the status of a fish that will remain small forever, we'll call them sardines, what that status is in terms of bishalakum, is not a suffix in halacha. There are two types of sfeikos in the world, okay? There's a suffix in halacha. I don't know how to basket, right? There's a machlokas between the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, the Rambam and the Ramban. There's a suffix in Metzius, or what the Rav Uvadja calls a suffix in Chesron Yediyah. I just don't have a piece of information. If I had that piece of information, it would inform me whether I should be Mekil or Mach. So when I'm missing a piece of information, says Rav Uvadja, I cannot be Mekil even by Isser Derabanan. Right? When we apply the rule called suffix Derabanan Lekula, that's only true for a suffix in halacha. But if I have a suffix in metzius, where I just can't figure out a piece of information, that's not good enough. Why? Because go figure out the piece of information that you're missing. What do you mean? I'm going to rely on a suffix. No, figure it out. Go figure out what your information that you're missing. Okay? And too bad, we'll figure it out. Rabbi just says it's not a good enough answer. It's not an answer to say, oh, I don't know what the metzius is, therefore I'm going to make it. And if it's a question of suffix and halakha, okay, fine. So we're never going to resolve the suffix. If my information that's missing is, a Wikipedia page away, so then go figure it out. Go to Wikipedia, figure out what you're missing.
Not always true. Anybody can edit it.
Not the point.
What is
the
point? Something that there's no way to know.
Like what?
Like it's not about sauce. Like what is your barbecue?
Yeah. So you have to be cognizant of what's going on with your grill, figure out whether there is chicken on the grill. You know I'm saying? There are certain things that you can test or you can know by putting in a drop of Hishtadlus to figure those things out. Okay, guys, turn to page 68. Guys, page 68. Rav Uvadja continues in the Shuva, and he tells you exactly the process of how they smoke sardines. So first he says, they smoke the sardines. Okay, pretty simple. Then they put the sardines into a boiling vat of hot water. Sounds pretty painful. And then they finish cooking it. Now, here's the machlokas that we alluded to before. When I smoke the sardines, when I do ishun on the sardines,
is it edible?
Not as an edible. Well, maybe. The question is that called bishul? When I smoke sardines, when I smoke salmon, when I smoke lox, is that called bishul? So that's a big machlokas, whether smoking has a status of bishul. What? It's similar to those things. It doesn't entail water. That's the point. It doesn't entail any water. Right? As opposed to cooking, which involves water, roasting involves either no or minimal water, and smoking involves generally no water. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're different. They're used for different foods, right? You wouldn't smoke. I mean, theoretically, you could smoke anything, I guess. But
what do you do?
What's the actual process? So when you're smoking something, you put it into a room, fill the smoke, and it gets smoked. That cooked, it gets smoked, right? When you want to roast something, it's like roasting something in a room that's full of smoke, basically. Okay? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, guys, so what? Actually, why do we smoke? Why do they smoke the sardines first before they start the rest of the process? They want to soften the sardines in order to lose the tzura of a fish, right? Because we want to pack sardines into a can, so it's not so convenient to have all the sardines looking like sardines. We want to kind of just smush them in there and, put the seal on it. So he says that apparently there are types of sardines that do in fact grow bigger, So therefore, the point that even the Baku says that I have, if I have fish, it will stay small forever. Those can be Ola, but some of the sardines will grow bigger. Well, it's not because of Suffolk. It's that now there's a chance. They will. There are sardines that grow bigger. Therefore, it's not going to be Ola Shulchan. Ravaji says that small sardines apparently taste different than big sardines. I'm not holding in sardines. I don't know. I assume none of you are either. Okay, so we can ask him. Also, Ravaji points out that eating berekas are also not a problem of bishalako because there's apparently berekas are smoked. I don't know that. You guys know that? Berekas are smoked. Yeah. What are berekas? Have you ever been to Israel before?
Potatoes. Right now.
Yeah. What?
Where is that right now?
Let's go to Yahoo George. They're the best
burekas. I don't know. I don't know the first thing about how to make burekas. But Ravaji claims that burekas are smoked, apparently.
Very possible.
Now, Ravaji says further, bottom page 69. They cook the sardines. They cook the sardines right after they catch them. But he says the heter is that they're smoked, meaning they're not cooked. But, says Ravaji, why is it our sugya? Tuna is usher. Why is tuna usher? Because they cook the tuna without first smoking it. So Ravaji says, because they're cooking the tuna, that's going to be a problem with fish. Guys, where have you ever heard of like mashed tuna fish plants? Where are tuna plants generally? Where do they exist generally?
The ocean.
Somewhere in the middle of like the Pacific Ocean. Somewhere like, I'll tell you a funny story. A couple of years ago, four or five summers, whatever it was. Right, it was like 2 weeks before Cola started. It was, I think, maybe my first summer in Madrid, whatever it was. I get an email from Andrew Israeli, Rabbi Israeli, sends an email out to all the staff, and he says that they're looking for a mashkiach to go to Indonesia for 2 weeks to be a mashkiach in a tuna fish plant. Okay, and they'll pay for you, they'll pay for your hotel, blah, 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 blah. So I actually offered to go, but apparently they found someone else. So I didn't end up going. I was too late. So whatever. So someone else went. I don't know who went.
So you got stuck here.
But if you... No, I was going to be here anyway. But if you... If you've ever been to the OU, so people from the OU all the time, people who are big mashkicha, they travel all over the world to give like hakshirim or like tuna plants in Indonesia or all these like random whatever. Like, there are all these things that exist all over the world. It's crazy. Like, and they go to China to go give an hakshirim on like, I don't know what. So that's what happens in the world of kashas. Okay. Anyway, just a side point. Now, Ravaji in the bottom of page 70 continues, and he says that there was a rumor that was going around that there was treif fat that was mixed in with the fish, and apparently there was something about olives from Italy. I don't know all the background behind this truva and like what the historical context of this truva was, but basically there was a rumor going around that treif fats were getting mixed into the sardines. What? You call it shuma tamay. It's not necessarily chila per se. Fish don't really have chila. I know there's like a technical term that applies to animals more, but the point is some sort of treif lard of sorts was getting mixed in to the sardines to the fish. And he says in his olives from Italy, the Ramah, so apparently the Ramah debunked the latter. There was a myth going around the times of the Ramah that these olives from Italy that were supposed to be kosher had some sort of treif fat mixed into it or something. So the Ramah said, no, it's not true. How did the Ramah know that the myth was incorrect? Anyone guess? How did the Ramah figure out that the olives from Italy were really kosher and that they didn't have treif oil mixed into the olives? Because it says because the Ramah tasted the olives and then it tastes treif. He says the Ramah tasted the olives, and they tasted like what? He says they didn't taste like Isra. So the Amish is like, how did the Ramah know what Isra tasted like? The Korah, he never ate like tray fat. Well, that's a different dish. That's a different kasha. That we're not gonna get to right now. Yeah.
Yeah, but could Pat say that if you knew what the kosher words tasted like, that there might be like not a chazaka. I know that all kosher olives taste like this. So
Ravaji writes a similar sara. Ravaji says that it could be that we have this like intuition. We know that kosher and treif just taste different. But it's like a really weird sara because like we don't know what to, like we don't have anything compared to like what does treif taste like? It's different than kosher. I have no idea. Now the truth is, guys, what's Rav Moshe's famous kula about Chol Yisrael? Why does Rav Moshe think that Chol Yisrael is technically mother?
Chol star.
I'm not calling stop. Sorry, you're right. I'm not calling stop. You're right.
If
you trust the FDA, they'll regulate, and because of, and they're going to penalize people who try to mix in pig milk or whatever, right? So you can rely on that. So Ravaji quotes a similar story right here. He says because there are penalties that are imposed by the health department and by whatever, the FDA. So therefore, the assumption is that as a result, right, what's going to happen? No one's going to want to mix in shreif and tummy fats with the olives or whatever as a result. But Rav Ajin does admit that Rav Kook says that it's not such a big sorah because it was so, the amount of the penalty that was imposed was so minimal that it could have been worth it to mix some fats at the expense of getting, you know, a little bit of a fine later on. So Rav Kook wasn't so convinced that that was a valid sorah. Now, going to page 71 for a second, because this is just finishing up the tshuva's last point here. Rav Ovadia says at the end of the tshuva, good? Yep. Can I get a drink? Good? Good? Okay, good. So Rav Ovadia says at the end of page 71, he quotes from this person named Rav Yaakov Beirut, someone, I don't know, Rav Ovadia quotes random people all the time. Rav Yaakov Beirut. He says, don't eat the butter from France. Whatever you do, don't eat French butter. Why not? Why shouldn't you eat French butter? Because French butter...
Because they're trying to kill Jews.
Well, that's true, but that's nothing to do with this. French butter, apparently, is 70% chazer fat. It's a lot of chazer fat. 70% of this French butter, according to Rav Yaakov Beirut, was 70% chazer fat. Now, they tried running chemical tests on this butter to actually see if it was 70% chazer fat or not. And apparently... there were some machlokas between the chemists about, there were different numbers and different percentages, so it was very unclear what the maskana was. And he says that even though...
One.
He says...
You know, Bakta Bashisha.
What? Well, Bakta Bashisha, that's what we spoke about yesterday. You can't do that with Lechachila, right? We spoke about this yesterday about smoothies. You can't do that with Lechachila. Now...
Right, but this is a video of a circumstance.
Well, correct, but I shouldn't be buying butter if I know there's even a trace of chazer, right? Now, even though Rav Ajin says the Ramah blew this whole thing off, remember we saw the Ramah before? What did the Ramah say? Yeah, of course you can eat the olives from Italy, right? Why? They taste kosher, right? So even though the Ramah blew that off before, Rav Ajin says, Aruch HaShulchan writes, you gotta find a professor. You gotta find someone who knows what he's doing. That's what
a connoisseur.
No, he calls him a chemist, actually. If you look, I'm just reading to page 71. It's the 6th and 7th line, see, by the period. The Isha Hishilu. See where that is? Page 71. Like the 7th line, I think. By the period, the middle line. The Isha Hishilu Livchon Advarim Ayideh Hafrada Kimit. They use chemical testing. Achlo Kol HaBokhanim Ba'ul Eime Kashaveva. So not all the chemists came to the same conclusion. Why? They had different, like, tests and litmus tests or whatever to figure out the percentages of fat. They could not come to any sort of, reasonable conclusion about this issue. Therefore, he says, you're better off going to find a guy who knows what he's talking about and figuring out whether this stuff is really kosher or not. Okay? That is Rav Ovadia. Now, do that too. If you take a look at the top page 72, the Shevet Halevi writes something crazy. The Shevet Halevi says that when they close the sardine cans, the zeya, which literally means the sweat, but in this context means the liquid and the juices and all the other gross stuff in the sardine can, cooks the sardines. That stuff in the can, that like stuff that you can't really put your finger on, that like intangible heat source in the can, is what is cooking the sardines. So therefore, he says there may be less of an issue in that context. Now, we're going to go back to what we spoke about a little bit yesterday. Guys, just a quick chazar from yesterday. Remember we spoke about yesterday?
Smoothies.
But more specifically, we spoke about checking the lungs, right? Remember we spoke about checking the lungs yesterday a little bit, right? The notion of checking the lungs of an animal. Right, guys, why do you have to check the lungs of an animal? What's the word for it? Amir Hamatsu, right? What do we say? What was the number for Amir Hamatsu? We're going to bring in 10%, right? 10% is Amir Hamatsu. Over here, the Shulchan Aruch, bio page 72 writes, you have to check the lungs when you shecht an animal to make sure it's not a trefa. And also, if you've ever seen a shechita, you'll see they oftentimes blow into the lungs of the animal also. I've done this before, actually, in Kola. You take the trachea of the animal after it's shechted, you blow into it, the lungs expand, and this way, you can run your finger over the lungs to make sure there's nothing there, make sure there's no, what are called sirchas. What?
I told my stomach about that, they had a mesotherapy and stuff, and he
was checking. Yeah.
And then your mouth goes
like that. Yeah.
Didn't it hold the lungs?
It depends. depends on what you're seeing, but most likely. I mean, at least from a halachic perspective. Again, I can't give you an intelligible answer, legabe, like clobby science, because I don't know what the percentage of the animals that have holes in their lungs that die. Like, I can't give you a number, but apparently 10%. But 10% of the animals that have a hole in their lungs. That's not a crazy number. With holes in their lungs? Well, meaning, if that assumption is correct, if 10% of animals have holes in their lungs, it's not so crazy to think those animals are going to die within a year. I mean, a hole in your lungs is a pretty big deal, no? You think the number is too high? Is that what you're saying? Okay, so look at the Biscay Chuba. Look at the Biscay Chuba, okay? Look. I hear you. Look at the Biscay Chuba, page 73. Biscay Chuba discusses the following crazy scenario. This has nothing to do with kashrus per se, but the application of this shaila is very relevant. There is a famous story that's reported about the Chasam Sofer, where a person during his time period had died, and they were going to bury him. And as they're as they're burying him, you hear a knock on the coffin. The guy's not dead. The guy's still alive. They had buried a live person, obviously not realizing he was alive. There was a whole controversy as a result of that story where they made a decree that you have to wait 3 days to bury a person. So that's all sorts of problems in terms of halacha, because you can't wait 3 days to bury people in normal circumstances.
Why did they think he died?
What? Because apparently he like stopped breathing, whatever it was. The government. Yeah. So says the Biscay Chuba. Says the Biscay Chuba. Guys, let me ask you a very controversial question. When does a person die? It is. Or more specifically, the guy stops breathing, right? Okay, we're not getting into the brain death issue right now. That's way beyond the scope of our topic. The Piskei Chuva quotes from this story that once a person stops breathing, he's dead. What about the guy who came back to life 3 days after he died? He says that's a miut to miut. He says that's not even a miut to miut. He says that is so incredibly unlikely to ever happen again. It's like a 1 in a billion chance. We don't even have to be choshi lechatchila for that. Meaning, if a person dies, I can lechatchila and I should lechatchila bury him and not think about, oh, maybe he'll come back to life in 3 days. Like, that's not. Well, again, you have to put your mind in like 1700 science.
It's not like you don't have to hook them up to the machine,
that's what I'm saying. In the 1700s, no one's getting hooked up to anything. If you stop breathing in the 1700s, you die.
Look, any guy, I'm gonna say nowadays, no.
Hey, nowadays is different.
If you're on the street and it has a pulse, you're very likely, above it is unlikely to save them.
Good.
If you just give them breath, you don't have to hook them up to anything.
Apparently, 300 years ago, it wasn't the case. I don't know, maybe no one would do CPR. When was CPR invented? I guess technically Alicia. Alicia, I know, invented CPR. But he actually did resuscitation, which I guess would be relevant for this case.
Eliyahu Hanavi.
Alicia. Yeah. Alicia. Alicia. Eliyahu.
Eliyahu,
yeah. Well, if it makes me feel any better, and it won't. But the Piskei Chuva says that if you question this idea, and you question this notion that, like, breathing is death, he says, you're questioning the Shekhinah. So, I'll read you the last line he says here. He says,
Well, okay, fine.
Basically, you can take it out with the Piskei Chuva. I don't know. Take it out with it. Okay, let's that was on the side. No, obviously Basmanazeh is going to be doing it. Come on. Let's keep Basmanazeh, and three years. Now, back to our topic. Says Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. Who is Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank? Anyone? He was the Rav of Yerushalayim in the early 1900s. He wrote something called the Har Tzvi. He was asked about eggs from Shanghai. Why not? Eggs from Shanghai, China, that do not have a hashkacha, but they claim that they come from chickens. Are those eggs kosher? Now, we know Basmanazeh, you can never trust the Chinese about anything, right? The question is, are these eggs that come from Shanghai, are these kosher eggs? Can we assume that they're kosher? So, we already pointed out a couple of times in the turkey sugya, we pointed out that the Torah delineates 24 tree birds, the Gemara Chulin says, the implication of that Sukkot, that there are more kosher birds than tree, because we know that Rashi makes the comment all the time. But whenever the Torah delineates something, it's delineating the minority, implying the majority is the opposite. So the Torah says there are 24 tree birds, you don't know. The Gemara gives these crazy numbers of how many kosher birds that exist in the world, like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of kosher birds. We don't know the species, but we know that they exist. So Tosu says, even though there are far more kosher birds than non-kosher birds, right? Tosu says that it could be that the non-kosher birds have a lot of eggs. So just because they have only 24 non-kosher birds doesn't necessarily mean that the eggs are all automatically going to come from a kosher bird. The Ramban writes that if you're... What? That's true too. Then the Ramban says that if you're Mitzari, a miut of Nevelos and Trifos, let's say for example, I have a minority of animals that may be Nevel and Trifa, so then he says that the Tehorim won't even be in the rope. Meaning if I take my eggs, and I'm not sure if the eggs come from kosher or non-kosher animals, and I want to not be Mitzari for those eggs with other animals, so if I take a couple of kosher animals that turn out to be a Nevel or Trifa, now I'm back to where I started from. Now I have the rule of the opposite, in the wrong direction. I have a rule of animals being non-kosher. Now, what's the heter that allows us to just go ahead and buy? Are we allowed to walk into a store and buy eggs without a heter on them? We do it all the time, right? Go to a store and buy eggs. Eggs don't have heter. That's true. They're just like a water bottle. Should not. Hopefully doesn't have a heter on it, because if it does, it's probably already. Don't buy a water bottle that has a heter on it, ever, right? It's because you probably might have like made a shard that has a heter on it, right? Don't buy water without a heter on it. Because water doesn't need a heter, it's water. Unless you're afraid there are cold pies in your water bottle. But there are.
Why should you not buy water?
Because I'm a Kanai in the wrong way. Anyway, I'm a Kanai in the wrong direction. Anyway, so he quotes from the Rishonim that we buy eggs from the store without looking for a heter. What's the heter for that? Because what are the chances that the eggs I'm buying, like, what are the odds is coming from like an eagle? Of course they're not coming. Of course these are going to be kosher eggs, right? The Magen Mishnah claims that the heter. Right. The Magen Mishnah claims that the heter to buy eggs is based on the fact that we can recognize kosher and non-kosher eggs. Again, couldn't tell you what non-kosher eggs look like. I probably haven't seen them ever in my life before. So he says we can recognize them. But he says that those are the two different approaches as to what the heter to buy eggs is going to be. What? Apply what? Well, no. Obviously, certain things are going to require an action. Because certain things, when you buy an egg, right? You're buying the egg. Nothing went from the time the egg was laid, or the egg was, however, made to the store. Sugar has other ingredients than bread. Exactly. So you think that you need to have stuff. You just want to see what's going on. If it's pure, like water.
Would it need to have sugar?
Right. So theoretically, if you had a purely raw ingredient, then
what about minerals?
Plain minerals.
What about wheat? What about if you buy flour?
So theoretically, if you have a completely raw ingredient, then yes, you would not need. Okay, if you find something which is a purely raw ingredient, so it may appear that it probably doesn't. Okay, I don't know. Go ask your local Orthodox rabbi. I don't know. He'll tell you what the deal is. Okay, now. Okay, fine. That's already a little bit off topic. Go to page 74 for a second. This is very important. It's not so relevant for this subject. It's important to know in general. We spoke about before that there's a klal, you know, in halakha, that we always follow the rope, right? How do we know? Parshas says always.
Yeah, it's good.
Okay, good, we got it.
By the way, I think your
question,
my favorite part of the
Torah,
is everything.
Yes, it does. Good? Torah says, follow the rope? Follow the rope, correct. So he says, what if I have a situation where, let's say, I want to figure out, is the egg kosher or is it not kosher? Is the bird kosher or is it not kosher? But let's say, I can't figure it out. I have no idea if the egg is kosher or not, if the bird is kosher or not. Then he says the din is you always follow the rove. Now, I can rely on the rove to establish the species of bird that I'm dealing with, but when it comes to an egg of a bird is not a species, it's just an egg, right?
So, the egg might not fertilize.
Okay, one second. That's true too. if you hold like the Mayan Mishnah, who said before that it depends on Tzvius, I just tell the difference between kosher and non-kosher. Okay, that makes sense. Then I can just figure it out. But if eggs are just like animals, I can tell the difference between, but eggs all look the same to me. So then there's no way to determine based on a rove whether it's a kosher or not kosher egg, because all the eggs are just, they all look the same, right? There's really no way to figure out whether that egg is going to be kosher or not. Therefore, there would not be a rove on the egg. On the eggs, there's no rove. On the animals themselves, you can go based on whether it's kosher or not. Say, let's say I find an animal that I can't figure out if the animal's kosher or not. So I see it. 9 hours of the animals moving this region are kosher, probably kosher. And if not, not, right? But what if I find an egg? Let's say I live in a place where the animals that live here are kosher, right? And I find an animal, I'm not really sure what status this animal is. So then I follow the rove, determine the kosher animal. That's a din. So, again, that based on... Let's say, I don't know, it's an animal. Let's say the donkey was born from a cow. It was, I don't know, one of these crazy Makoto's case recorded earlier, right? Looks like a trip animal. But, the Haritzu points out, we know there's a din. The Pasuk says, right? That's a mitzvah d'oraisa. What's that mitzvah? What does that Pasuk mean? Dehiv daltem? What does that mean practically? To separate. What does that mean? The Rambam writes in the beginning, very beginning of Hilchos Macholos Asuros, there's a mitzvah saseh to identify and know which animals are kosher and which are not. The mitzvah saseh doraisa. You have to know which animals are kosher and which are not. Says Rav Tzipias Afraid, that mitzvah only applies to the animals themselves, but not to the eggs of the animals. The animals themselves, that then applies, but not to the eggs. Okay. If you flip to page 75, the Minchas Yitzchak, this really will just kind of close off our discussion here about sardines. The Minchas Yitzchak just writes that, first of all, there's no bishul akka for things that are mass produced in a factory. Why is that true? What did we say before?
Because you're not going to have any desire to.
Not that there's not any desire, it's not even shy. So. Right, it's not happening. And also he says, this is the question we raised earlier, that smoking something is not called cooking, right? When I smoke salmon, whatever, that's not called cooking. So again, when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, it's not going to matter. You're chayav anyway, right? When it comes to... Why not?
My ex has bishul.
But when it comes to bishul akum and...
What about smoking after something goes out? Would you be allowed to do that on Shabbos?
Ishud akar bishul kind of thing? Interesting, cute question, interesting question. I don't know, it's an interesting question. Okay, so that is, meaning if it's an ain, if it's the machmir for the Urayim, we're not going back to that cigarette. As a chumrah, who says we have to extend that chumrah to other? Who says we have to extend the Urayim chumrah to other to smoke it? Maybe it's only went to buy roasting and buy vegan. I don't know, I'm not sure. Guys, let's recap. Let's recap the sugya of tuna fish. Guys, what are some of the issues of tuna fish we mentioned?
What?
Number one, is it kosher? Maybe they don't even have scales. We said, no, they have scales. They fall off. They can't get the peel, right? We said that. Right? What the status is?
By mine,
exactly. It has to be in the water. So as long as the scales are in the water, that's okay. What was the chumrah reported from the Ramah with Akiva and the Kamachayim's svara to explain? Yes?
It has to be like by its tail, its jawbone, or in its face.
Meaning, if it only has one scale in one of those places, that it's good, but anywhere else, not. What was the star behind that?
If it's anywhere else, it might be from a different fish.
A different fish, right? That was Akiva's star, might be a different fish, therefore it may not be okay. Right? We spoke about the issue of sardines, official akum, right? So a question about smoking, is that considered to be official, right? Factories, the distinction of paspalter for a certain chuba, all these different distinctions we pointed out. And we ended off by saying, number one, there's no official akum in factories. That's the spar behind why, generally speaking, during the most of the year, paspalter is liquor, except for maybe a certain chuba for not here. That's why you can eat dummy donuts, but not entrance to the boats are fried, entrance are baked. So during a certain chuba, you can't be not here. And also, we pointed out that smoking is not called cooking in this regard.